This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk. My guest is Nathaniel Philbrick, author of Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War. When did the pilgrims leave in the Mayflower, and how long did it take them to get to New England?
Well, they left in September of 1620, way late. They should have left months before, and were hit by a series of westerly gales, and this was an old ship, so she was quickly leaking, and they were out there for 10 weeks. It's been estimated the Mayflower averaged between 1.5 and 2 miles an hour in its slow slog across 3,000 miles of ocean.
Did they know in advance where they would land, or was
their destination originally was the Hudson River. They could have been our first New Yorkers, but they were more than 200 miles off course and found themselves off Cape Cod. The captain heads south, but they run into a shoal that nearly wrecks the ship, and he says, "Wait a minute, I'm going to go around the tip of Cape Cod, park the ship in what's now Provincetown Harbor, and get these people off my ship as fast as I can."
Who were the pilgrims?
Well, they were religious extremists of their day. They were Puritan separatists who believed that the Church of England was
not like insurgents.
No, not insurgents, but I mean they believed that they had to separate from the existing church to worship God as God intended. And this was illegal in England at the time. So they then emigrated to Holland, more religiously tolerant, and set up shop there for more than a decade, but began to worry that their children were becoming Dutch. And so they couldn't go home. What to do? Go to the New World and reconnect with their ancestry, but be free of the British bishops and do their own thing.
Did they invent the word pilgrim?
They never applied that to themselves. Like so much of this story, what we take for granted to be part of their world had nothing to do with whatever. It comes from a phrase in William Bradford's Of Plymouth Plantation, one of the great books ever written in the 17th century. And he says, their true destination was heaven, not of this earth. They were pilgrims in their lives. And so it stuck.
How much did the pilgrims and the local Indians interact?
A tremendous amount. It took a little while, though. In the beginning, the pilgrims, they had no idea where they were, and they spent a month searching for a settlement site. And they did everything wrong when it came to the Indians. They found some corn buried in the sand. They knew they shouldn't steal it, but they stole it. They found a grave that they knew they shouldn't ransack, but they were curious what's in here. They ransacked it, and they were soon trading shots with Indians a few days later in what's now called First Encounter Beach.
What were the weapons of the day?
The pilgrims had muskets, and you know, nothing like the weapons that would develop. I mean, that you couldn't really aim them in a traditional way, and we call matchlocks, and so that you had to light the match, and it was very long and reloading. The Indians had bow and arrows, and they could, and compared to a matchlock musket, these things were very effective. Mm-hmm. They could have five arrows in the air at once, very powerful. And so, you know, yes, there's a technological edge to the pilgrims, perhaps, mm-hmm. but if you're in a dust up on a beach, I think I'd rather have an experienced bow and arrow person than a religious devotee with a musket staggering mm-hmm. around.
How do you pronounce the name of the tribe?
The Wampanoags.
Wampanoags.
Yes.
After the first month, then what?
Well, after the first month, the pilgrims settled in Plymouth Harbor. And the reason they liked this was because there was no Indians there. And clearly there had been Indians, but there weren't at this point. And they settled in and started building houses. But the winter had come in already, and people began to sicken and die. And that winter, more than half of them would die, and it was just 2-3 dying a day. And by the time spring came, they were fearful that the Indians were just waiting them out until they couldn't put up any resistance.
How many were there, by the way?
There were 102 original passengers, just slightly over 50 would survive that first winter. Mm-hmm. Entire families were killed that winter, and more than half a dozen orphans created. And it was a terribly traumatic situation that really reshuffled everything when it came to, you know, the demographics of the group. And so it was with great surprise when an Indian approached them and said the words, "Welcome, Englishmen," spoke their language, and they just couldn't believe this.
How did he know the language?
Well, for decades, European fishermen had been cod fishing along the coast of New England. And this Indian was actually from Maine, so had come down south. And through his interaction with English cod fishermen, had learned enough. He wasn't, you know, terrific, fluent with the language, but knew enough to say welcome Englishmen.
And how many months was it before the first Thanksgiving?
Well, the first Thanksgiving, and hey, that's a phrase the Pilgrims never used. They never called it a Thanksgiving. But it was that first year. It wasn't in November like we celebrated. It would have been a traditional harvest festival in late September, early October.
How did Thanksgiving here become the fourth Thursday in November?
Yeah, you know, it's what happened was, and that's why everybody knows the Pilgrims. They've got a national holiday. And Abraham Lincoln established Thanksgiving as a national holiday during the Civil War. The hope was that, you know, our country has been fractured in two pieces. What we need is a national holiday that, you know, inspired by the Pilgrims, that brings everyone together. And in fact, there was a movement to start it as a holiday even before the war broke out.
What's the most significant thing the Pilgrims and the Indians accomplished?
I think the most significant thing, and this is something that most people really have no understanding, is that, yes, there was the first Thanksgiving, but then there was also more than half a century of relatively peaceful coexistence that followed that. And given the subsequent history of Native Western relations in this country, that is amazing. I mean, for more than two generations, people were living and working together. It was not a utopia. The two peoples did not necessarily understand each other or like each other all the time. But the leadership understood that if we don't make this work, if we don't do everything we can through diplomacy to stave off tensions, the alternative is a war that is in nobody's best interest. And they held it together for that long.
You tell the stories of these times through the people. Yeah. Who were the main players?
Well, first off, when it comes to the Pilgrims, it's William Bradford. Mm-hmm. He was governor for the majority of his life in the New World, and he was the one who really held them together. And he seems to have been a very thoughtful, wise man in his own way, filled with tremendous religious faith, but he was also very good at working with the Native Americans, and I think that's the key to the success of Plymouth Colony.
And the chief of the Indians was remarkable as well.
Yes, Massasoit, because he had seen his people through a terrible time. In the years before the arrival of the Mayflower, his people were hit by a series of European spawn diseases, probably introduced by those European fishermen in Maine that had worked their way down, killing in some instances 90% of the people. That's why there are no Indians in Plymouth Harbor when the Pilgrims arrived. And he said, okay, and the rival tribe to the west, the Narragansetts, were threatening to take them over. It was a very calculated and cagey decision. He said, well, maybe an alliance with this group of Englishmen will give me a way to protect my people against the threat to the west. And he did this with extreme ambivalence. He didn't know if this was the right thing, but he finally decided to do it. And for the next half century, there would be peace.
And then what happened after that half century?
Well, then there is a war about which most Americans know absolutely nothing.
I know, Philip's War, King Philip's War.
Yeah. I mean, the name's a little deceptive. I think a lot of people hear that and assume it's a European monarch and has something to do with the French and Indian Wars.
Was there an English king named Philip? But it wasn't even.
No, it was Massasoit's son, Philip, who was was referred to as King Philip. And in 1675... he would lead his people in a war against the sons and grandsons of the original Pilgrim settlers. And this war would change everything.
Why did he do it?
You know, he felt he had no choice, because what had happened was, during those decades, more and more land had gone into English hands. And this becomes a real estate game in many ways. And the young warriors of the Wampanoag said, what good is this alliance? We need to get it back. And he didn't have a very good relationship with the leadership of Plymouth Colony, and Plymouth Colony was becoming more and more unscrupulous when it came to the Native American relations. And it was the English fault as much, if not much more, than the Native fault when it came to the ultimate outbreak of violence.
Well, thank you. My guest is Nathaniel Philbrick, author of Mayflower, A Story of Courage, Community, and War, published in paperback by Penguin. This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk.